All right, so you ready for the big intro?
I can't wait to hear it.
Okay, buddy, here we go. It was September 28th, 2013. My pregnant wife and I traveled with our one-year-old to Halifax for her brother's wedding. It was a picturesque day for a wedding, and after a nice family gathering and ceremony in Point Pleasant Park, we made our way out for dinner and then, of course, revels at the Carlton. It was there that I was first introduced to my guest today, Mr. Adam Baldwin. Like a magic coincidence, he happened to be there with his band to help us celebrate our occasion. The first song the band played that night was I'm on Fire, and they tore through a cavalcade of great selections that made me feel like this low Telecaster hanging band leader was picking songs out of my own personal playlist. One by one, sadly, each member of my own party soon parted. Some had early flights. My wife was, of course, pregnant at the time and tired, and it was a long day for everybody, but not me. I was in it for the long haul. I was shutting the Carlton down that night. The night ended with a series of Bruce Springsteen songs, which may have been in large part to the fact that I kept yelling more Bruce. The following morning, I had a sore throat and a nasty hangover, but I remember having yet another incredible Halifax musical experience. As someone who also gigs regularly, I hadn't had that much fun watching another pub band in a long time. Well, probably since the last time I was in Halifax, actually. I tried to explain the magic I'd seen to everyone the next morning, but they don't hear and feel music the same way that I do. I kept kicking myself that I didn't exchange information with the band guys or make some sort of effort to follow the band on social media. So fast forward to October 9th, 2016. Again, my wife and I, now with two kids, jumped at the rare chance when a concert we both liked was in the area and our schedules worked and the babysitter was available. So we headed north to see Blue Rodeo at the Key to Bala. He played a Strat for the first four songs, but when he switched to the Telecaster, that low-hanging Telecaster, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It's them. It's him. The set was incredible. I was blown away. My wife and I shared a really special moment. I left with a CD, a vinyl, and a pack of pins. No telling when, precisely 1985 was the album, featured the singles Daylight, as well as a promo video for Love on the Rocks. The album was the winner of Music Nova Scotia's Rock Recording of the Year and had three separate nominations for the East Coast Music Awards. On March 29th of this year, Adam released the focused and intense No Rest for the Wicked. Recorded in Halifax and New York by Gus Van Gogh and Werner F., the album builds on the promise of Baldwin's award-winning No Telling When record and reveals a new sharpness to the skills he's honed over the better part of 15 years, toughing it on the road and in the studio, both solo and as a part of Matt Maid's band.
Oh, that's great. I'm out of time, though. Thanks for that. I got to go. We'll talk
to you soon. Thank you so much. I just wanted you to know the whole story. So, you guys just happened to be playing the one night. Small wedding. And, like, we're from Ontario. My brother-in-law lives in Gander. And we kind of met halfway in Halifax. And it was an excuse to go there. And
right. I love hearing stories like that. It's, playing in pub bands or any bands. You hope that you work your way into people's memories and you hope that it means something, and you've got like the dates and everything. It's a privilege that not many folks have to be a part of people's lives like that, I think. And it's nice to hear people kind of, it's nice to be reminded of that.
This year, I mean, I was pumped when you made the announcement that, you were going to be releasing new music, but I don't think I was ready for what was going to happen. Like, the record is deep, and you went to a deep place to get it. And I want to kind of kick off the interview by saying, like, what has the release of the record actually meant to you, considering where it came from?
It's not so much that I went to a deep dark place to write that. It was that I was kind of coming out of a real extended period of real sadness and darkness, and so it was a relief, truthfully, for me to get it all sort of on paper and then on record. I exercised a lot of demons making those six songs, and I'm better for it, as a human being. I'm healthier for having gotten all that out and exploring that the way that I did. I mean, I came out of all that, you know, much much better than I went into it, certainly.
It feels like it's all on there. Like you didn't pull any punches. You didn't leave anything off the table. But
no, I don't think. I think that the music I like, and the songs that I love are songs that don't have any stones left unturned. You know, I think that wearing your heart on your sleeve as a songwriter is the most important thing you can do, and because I think people feel it and they hear it in the words and in the tone of voice that you're performing the lyrics with, and in the guitar playing and in the drumming and everything else. It's I think that that's it's like a palpable thing, and I think it's missing in a lot of stuff. So that's my little effort to kind of stay true to the artists that I admire so much.
And you know what? I hate reminding people of their past if I don't have to, because, you know, I think people should be looking ahead. But in one of the first interviews you can find of you online is an interview you did in Kingston at a gig, and you played Bonnie Raitt, kind of.
Yeah.
And you had the exact same sentiment when it was applied to the melting pot of songwriting and having input on songs. So, I mean, it's something that has been consistent in your whole life. I guess so. I'm trying to say that I think that's incredible that you've maintained this road and this like diligence about your craft.
Yeah, I learned that from Matt. Matt doesn't. He writes the songs the way he feels them, exactly the way he feels them, and he doesn't necessarily welcome outside influence, and nor do I. I think a song in its purest form, certainly lyrically, is how it's going to be the most potent and how it's going to reach the audience and have its biggest impact. And that doesn't necessarily mean it reaches everybody, but I think that it, you know, I, on some sort of cosmic level, I think that that those songs reach the people that need to have them the most, you know, and that's yeah. I mean, I'm glad that I'm glad I said that all those years ago in Kingston, because it's the way I felt, and it's the way I continue to feel.
Someday, but I'm a deadbeat. I'm the culprit. You ain't the only one who's ever gone.
I was going to say that it was important then, but I feel like it's even more important now, like you were just touching on, that music is lacking a level of substance that used to be found in almost every record that you had, whether you listen to a Dave Mason right. record or a Bruce Springsteen record, or even in a different way, like a Jim Croce record. Like, they were speaking about something, even if they were, you know, maybe some were being more delicate about it, but they were still speaking about something that was real and genuine.
Yeah. The human condition is what this is just me and maybe you, and there are people that there's some people that just want to listen to music to not feel anything. It's something they put on in the background while they're washing the dishes or whatever, but I think that there's still a lot of music fans out there that care about the sentiment behind a song, and that's what I find interesting to explore. For me as a songwriter, I don't want to sit in a room and make a commodity. I prefer to sit in a room and, you know, in the case of No Rest for the Wicked, I got demons I needed to exercise, and I had shit I had to get out of my system. And music for me is more than a commodity. It's how I sort of maintain some semblance of sanity.
Well, like Robert Robertson said, it's a goddamn way of life, right?
Yeah. It's an impossible goddamn way of life, I believe is what he says. But it's true. It's my way of life, and I when I was younger and trying to figure out who I was and why I was feeling the way I was feeling. Music was an escape from all that, and then it becomes a way of identifying all the things that are wrong with you and the things that are right with you, and it helped me identify who I was as a human being, and then it becomes a way you try to make a living, and then as a result of that, certainly in my case, it turns out when you're a self-employed guitar player and songwriter, you can't always afford health benefits, and
no.
you can't afford to go see a shrink, so music, as a result of my chosen line of work, has become the only therapy I can really afford, and it's sort of a catch 22, but it has served me well, so I try to serve it, I guess.
I kind of am going to contradict myself a little bit. I said that you didn't really leave anything on the table when it came to the new record, but your bio kind of talks about you writing 20 plus songs, so I guess in a way, but do you have any plans for the other material, or was it too raw, was it too much
no,
for
it,
the record, or is
it
more
it just wasn't as concise, it wasn't as focused, and I wanted to tell a bit of a story, and the other songs were just sort of redundant more than anything. They weren't as good, and they didn't need to be on there. Budgetary constraints sort of forced me to think about the songs more and decide which ones held the most water, I guess. And so that's where we landed.
Embrace it for you. The dark beside the dawn goes on and on.
To get you off the psychiatrist's couch here for a second, what made you, was it just the experience that Matt had with Once Upon a Hell of a Time for your reasons to go with Gus and Werner, or just because they have, you know, a crazy history, like Oceans Will Rise as a disgustingly great signing record, so is A Great Detachment, where we both share a fondness of Tara Lightfoot's last record. Was it just sort of just made sense sonically, or what was it? What was the choice behind Gus and Werner?
Certainly sonically, and just as a musical mind, you know, Gus did a little bit of producing on Once Upon a Hell of a Time, but most of that was Matt and Roll. And same with Great Detachment. I think Gus and Werner mixed that record, but I knew very little other than the sounds of those two records in particular, and they sound amazing.
Yeah.
So I knew that at the very least, sonically, I was going to come out with something that was really going to work. But having spoken with the fellow who made No Telling When, his name is Liam O'Neill, of Stills fame, and Gus managed the Stills, and so while I was making No Telling When, Liam spoke of Gus like this otherworldly kind of musical mind, and that's something I always sort of, you know, kept in the back of my head. So when it came time to make No Rest for the Wicked, my manager brought Gus's name up, and I said, "Yeah, let's try that." And I flew to New York, and I hung out with Gus and Werner for a couple of days, and I just sort of knew that these guys, we could get on the same wavelength. And I don't like being produced; I find it difficult. But you know, I can't say we disagreed on too many of the different directions that Gus and Werner kind of took some of the songs.
Is it a different opinion in what the vision should be, or?
Well, it's just how close I am to the songs. They're, you know, it's like it's like getting a stranger to dress your kids in the morning. You know, it's an uncomfortable thing. But when you wind up with good producers, they see the entire vision for the project, and I think it's important to sit down and talk about what that is first. And Gus and Werner and I did that, and explore the themes of whatever's going on, and then I think it's up to the artist to explain to the producer how they want the producer to produce it. I guess that's kind of where the three of us arrived. Is they became very aware of what I wanted to convey musically, and the great thing about working with other people, especially brilliant folks like Gus and Werner, is that they hear things that I just never would have heard, and they really can serve to make the songs better. And we call it demo-itis. You know, when you make a demo of your own song and you listen to it 100 times over, you become used to the arrangement, or you become used to certain sounds or drum beats or whatever, and it's hard to get rid of them. But Gus and Werner both, they can make a very compelling case as to why it should be this way, or why we should at least explore it this way or that way. And I felt like, you know, I never felt like the reins were being taken from me. They were only, you know, they were only there to help, and they have the best interests of the project, you know, in their heart.
Strange anymore. Come hither, come hither, buddy. You know I. you can see me. I know that you can hear me.
Can't help but feel like somebody must have turned to somebody at one point and said, I need salvation to sound like a bat out of hell.
Yeah,
that, that song comes at you hard. In a good way. In a good way.
The words, the way I described it to them is that I wanted it to sound like junkyard dogs, you know, that were inches away from one's face. You know, I never would have got those guitar tones or the drum pattern that they came up with was, stuff that was way outside of my my area of expertise. They nailed that one. We all nailed it. It's just that turned out exactly the way it I heard it in my head, which doesn't happen often.
It's such a statement song. I've always loved it when bands have done that, when the lead single, the lead taste off the album is here to kind of say like fuck you, listen to this. Like, I like that. I like the edge of that.
Yeah, that was the idea with that one. You know, that's a huge, it's a colossal departure from anything I've ever written, even. Just even as I was writing it, the chord progression is way different, and the way I sang it or sung it, sang, yeah. Whatever. It's I'd never been there before, and. And so when I think it was, there was a consensus around the office that one was going to be the first single, and hopefully it would sort of be like, oh, fuck, Baldwin's not, he's not in the Springsteen zone anymore. You know, he's gone somewhere else. That was the idea. I wanted that song to be as jarring to the listener as it was for me to write it, I guess. It felt like I was in a car accident when I was writing that song.
No, exactly. No, I hear you. In a sense, I could almost argue that if No Telling When was Born to Run, like this one could almost be your Darkness on the Edge of Town, because it was such a bit of a departure, yet only getting, again, more focused, more driven in a certain, articulate direction.
Yeah, I love the Springsteen comparisons. I love them. And they don't. They don't like that, and for a good reason, I guess. So it's always a challenge for me to try to get away, and I don't like doing it because I write songs the way I write songs. But yeah. They make a fair point. Nobody wrote Springsteen songs better than Springsteen ever, and I don't expect that I'll be the guy that does that to do that. However. Even as much as I try to disguise the Springsteen sort of influence, it still comes out. So as you just said, I still get comparisons to from Born to Run to Darkness on the Edge of Town to whatever, and I love it. I revel in it. It's my favorite thing to hear. It's the nicest compliment you could ever pay me, is to use any one of those records in the same sentence as my name or my record. And I will tell you this. You seem like an upstanding young man who's done his research. I will tell you this about the song No Rest for the Wicked.
Yes.
I can't remember what the line is exactly, but it's. I essentially took a line from Streets of Philadelphia. You're broken, battered, bruised and battered. I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. And No Rest for the Wicked. There's a line that says... You're broken, battered. It's in the first part of the verse somewhere, I think.
First part of the first verse?
Yeah, first part of the Now you're broken better. Now you know how I felt. Now you resemble nothing. Now you're somebody else. That is, it's just a, just like ever just so slightly yeah. rework the words from Streets of Philadelphia. Nobody's caught it yet.
No, eh? Even the record company, they're not doing their jobs.
No, they didn't catch it. They didn't get it. And I used the line in Delirious. I said, gun that bitch straight into the night. That's a line from a Springsteen song. Is it the Angel? What song is it? After the Flood? Or what's it called? Anyway,
you can find worse people to.
Right. You know exactly. I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
No. Yeah. That Lost in the Flood reference is for sure.
That's a deep one. That's a deep cut. But nobody's caught it yet.
Well, then maybe nobody has the Madison Square Garden live CD like I thought everyone did. But that's one of my favorite versions of that song is off.
Yeah. Totally. But,
anyway, I guess we could probably talk about Springsteen for the next couple hours, but I'm
totally.
But I have to just depart from your stuff for 1 second. I was really intrigued by the Collective Soul Run tweet. Like, because I shared affinity with that song, partially because I find that to be a very emotive song. And I can you talk about that? Because I can't have this conversation with many people, let alone an artist.
I forgot about that song entirely until I was having a bit of a rough week. I was really a malcontent, and I had a kind of a rotten conversation where I was acting like a baby. I was yelling at my manager about something. I was just feeling really, really bad, and I was standing in a Wendy's of all places, and that song came on the speaker in the restaurant, and I was ordering my supper for me and myself and my children, and it was all I could do not to weep.
Yeah.
It's like a bunch of, you know, nostalgia is such a powerful thing. And like my, you know, my every teen, you know, all these teenage parties that, you know, I was a teenager, I guess, when that song came out. I think it was like 99.
The song,
I would have been 13.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, the song's 99.
Yeah, but I just listened to that a lot in high school, and just a bunch of stuff came flooding back, and I drove home about 25 minutes. I drove listening to that song over and over again, and my kids, I'm sure, were in the back. And I don't know, 10, 15 years down the road, they're going to be like, oh, daddy listened to that song because he was depressed. Like, they'll remember that car ride where I just song over and over.
You know what? if you don't want to talk about it, flat out just tell them that you really, really liked Varsity Blues.
Yeah, right.
Because that song was cut.
You kids got to watch this.
And the thing is, one of the affinities I have with that song is that I love, there's a lyric, it's a second verse that I like so much about that song. I've written it down 1,000 times. But I was insulted when it was on the Varsity Blues soundtrack. I mean, it's a great song, and I'm glad millions of people got to hear it. And the line of, she says, I weaken with each voice that sings. Now in this world of purchase, I'm going to buy back memories. I was like, it's deadly. The song is absolutely deadly.
It just was just remarkable to me that I had forgotten all about it. I hadn't heard it in, Jesus, I, you know, 15, 16 years or something. And man, did it ever hit me hard in that garbage fast food restaurant. It was pretty incredible. And I love when that happens, you know, when you're reminded of those songs that have slipped away into the back corners of your memory.
Yeah.
And all this stuff was unlocked. So, you know,
the ether of your subconscious.
That.
Yeah,
man. It was awesome. It was just what the doctor ordered.
To run.
in the 90s, when I was growing up and really attaching myself to music, when I'm looking back on it now, all these amazingly uplifting, super depressingly lyrical songs came out. Like, it was a slew of them.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's why, like, why I'm so attached. Like, I can weep up when I hear Sixth Avenue Heartache.
Like, Oh my God, that song is so good, man.
It's amazing.
Every bit of it, yeah.
Like, an Adam Duritz totally. From The Crows is doing the harmonies in it. Like, just happened to be in the studio.
I didn't know that. That's
the singer from the Counting Crows right there.
Yeah, Counting Crows. How about Mrs. Potter's Lullaby? You remember that song? Speaking of Counting
Absolutely.
Crows.
Absolutely.
Where's that stuff now? Like, what a crazy song.
Like Broadway by the Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah.
You know
what I
mean? Like a super dark written song. Like Slide is about abortion. Black Balloon is about heroin. Broadway is about homelessness and like infidelity. Like, just, but again,
you
like.
You can't have success with songs like that anymore.
Cannot,
you cannot,
exactly.
And it's a drag because I just put out an EP about cocaine and sadness. Think of the business. It's the business people that are involved in this industry.
Yeah.
Who are very slow to catch up. The program directors and the you know, and the record label guys who are you know, have the fates of so many of us in their hands.
And it doesn't make sense to me because they all grew up with the same music.
At a certain point, program directors just become, I think that a lot of them probably get into it with the best of intentions, but they eventually turn into advertising salesmen and not music fans.
Definitely.
Or the owners of these stations buy, hire advertising salesmen instead of real music fans. And for God's sakes, guys like Bookie, easy. You know, there's nobody like him, and there's nobody like Alan Cross. I think George Stromboulopoulos is like the last guy that is able to have a radio show where he plays exactly what he wants to play all the time. But there's no tastemaker, to my knowledge, there's no tastemaker on the radio anymore. And I think that's why the industry is seeing a decline. I think they got to catch up with and just remember what made that medium so important. It's good songs, and that's what made radio.
It is.
I think there's a correlation between the absence of important music and a decline in advertising revenue.
Yeah.
we're talking about program directing and stuff like that, and radio and stuff. I love, and I didn't see a lot of the East Coast Hockey League stuff, but your tunes were all over that. I saw, or I read when you tweeted out, and I've noticed that the same plan of action has been put in. For like the playoffs and stuff, especially when the Leafs were in the playoffs, I was hearing nothing but Canadian content.
Yeah, I got, you know, I snuck into the Stanley Cup a little bit there too, and there was one game I was you know, something was supposed to be a part of the opening montage or whatever, and I got all excited, and then the game before it got delayed, and it wasn't on TV. But I mean, in any event, you know. I think that's a now look. Sportsnet's not breaking the bank too much to pay guys like me to have the songs up there. But I mean, I could argue it's probably pretty good exposure. There's certainly a lot of Canadian folks watching television, watching the hockey games, and so kudos to them for not taking like you know some big American band song. They do write by Canadian artists, and maybe it's a CRTC thing. I don't know. I don't really care. I thought it was really cool that the Memorial Cup played every night before the games. They had a different song of mine that was featured before the broadcast. And you know, that's more than I can say.
That's killer.
For any radio station in the country, you know, I'm struggling to get any airtime, but the good folks at Sportsnet, they grabbed a hold of it, man. I thought it was pretty cool. It was a bit of a trip to get messages from buddies of mine I haven't seen since high school and be like, hey man, I heard you on the Moosehead game or whatever. that's kind of cool.
So did you?
Because I was very bad at hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I was terrible. I tried to be forward defense, and they just stuck me in the net, and I was still a sick.
Yeah, right.
I know how a little bit how publishing works, but I know it's not really the most exciting thing for other people to talk about. Or to listen to two other guys talk about, I guess. But
let's get
right into it then. So did they just focus on new record stuff, or were they going through all your collection for the more cut stuff?
This go around, they used all the new stuff.
Beautiful.
So it was certainly a great promotional tool for that. And I mean, that's all stuff I tend to stay out of. But I got an email one day from the A&R guy, and he was like, "Hey, do you care if Sportsnet uses this?" I was like, "No, great. What are they paying?"
Yeah,
not much.
Exactly.
Cool, I'll take it. I could say no and not have national exposure. And I think they count on that, but, you know, it was cool of them to do. They could have picked an Arkell song or, you know, whatever. But they threw a little bone to one of the little guys, and I was thrilled about the whole thing.
Yeah, I know that's a great opportunity, especially because, I mean, I know the Memorial Cup. I don't mean to sound like an elitist because I'm closer to the GTA, but it seems like in the western and eastern parts of Canada, it seems to have a lot more of a dedicated following. With each and every game, whereas, you know, we will see the highlights here on, you know, good old Sportsnet 1 or whatever. But, yeah, that must have been wild. And my next question was going to be, did you have any input on what they were going to use? But it sounds like that you just said, have at it.
No, they grabbed it. They featured every song on the EP at some point during the thing. So it was ideal, really, you know.
You had vocal surgery.
I did, yeah.
In 2015, right? Or 2014, 2015.
I don't remember what year it was. I just done a couple shows with Arkells. I think it was the end of 2014, I want to say.
Well, your return.
No, maybe that doesn't matter. I don't remember when it was.
The return to the Carlton.
The end of 14 or 15. It was nice to get back and know that I could still sing. And I, you know, it turned out that all that was. I mean, I'm a cigarette smoker. That wasn't doing any good, but. I got a lot of anxiety in the way that I was carrying my shoulders. So they were tense all the time, and then that all worked its way up into my neck and into my throat and into my vocal cord. And so I had to kind of train myself again with a speech pathologist how to speak and how to just how to walk around, basically, not be so freaked out all the time. But it seems to have worked. It's stuck. Uh-oh, big truck going by here.
Here we go.
It all worked out. I haven't lost my voice since since I had that surgery. Thank goodness.
Yeah, my question was kind of more on the lines of like, was it just wear and tear, but it sounds like it was more of like an actual physical issue there.
Yeah, it was like the root cause of it was anxiety, basically.
Oh, jeez.
And yeah. But it all sort of, every time I walk through a doorway now, I sort of train myself like a dumb dog to check how my, you know, how tense I am.
Yeah.
And it took a while to do that, but it seems to have sort of saved the day, I guess.
Well, that's awesome. And listen, I'm now just sort of like freelancing this whole thing. I'm going to touch on your tour dates here. But quickly, though, how often are you doing the No Rest for Wicked Radio?
I had a grand ambition to do it a lot more often.
Yeah.
But I was renting a compressor from Long & McQuaid and renting a mic, and I sort of ran out of. I can't afford to do it right now. But I really enjoyed doing it. I had a lot of fun sitting in there and listening to songs maybe I hadn't listened to in a while, and breaking them down and examining them and
Cindy Lauper deep cuts.
Yes, deep Cindy Lauper cuts, and just I'd like to talk to some more people and try the interview thing out again. It was a good hobby to have. I enjoyed it, and I just thought it was kind of a fun way for anybody who listens to my music to get a bit of a handle on the weirdo that wrote all those songs.
Yeah,
you know.
No, I genuinely enjoyed it, and I love like the self-deprecating humor of it. How sometimes you're like, even if one person's listening, like, you know, I'm not even doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. Because it's sort of pre-recorded in a way. You don't really have that like immediate response of like people, you know, live chatting and stuff like that. But it's a pleasure to listen to. It really is. And as far as somebody who listens to music intently and also does put on some things that I just want in the background, it was great to like, you know, clean up my kitchen and listen to you, because then I would pick up on other song like stuff I hadn't heard, you know, whether it was, I mean, you know, I think everyone's heard Maria by Blondie, but you know, that Cyndi Lauper tune I had no idea about, nor the history of the other recorded version of it, which of course I then looked up, and then it's informative and it's nice, and I think that it's if you're doing it for you, it comes across that way. I appreciate you doing it anyways.
I'm glad.
Yeah, there are still a few tickets left for the Picton show. I know it's not a huge venue. Hopefully we'll be able to catch you out there. That's Thursday, June 20th in Picton, and you can get tickets at adambaldwin.ca/tour. I would offer tickets for the Burnstown show, but that puppy is sold out.
It's gone.
I really wanted to keep this just about you. I know you get a lot of references back to Matt, and it's part of your musical journey and stuff like that, but I really wanted to keep this about you so people could really get a lock on what you do and how great you are. And again, every time I hear Run by Collective Soul, I will now think of you. I appreciate you being honest, and this is a great interview. I had a lot of fun. And thank you very much for your time. Safe travel, brother, and the next time I come up to you, I will say, I'm the guy that talked to you and then saw you at Blue Rodeo.
Yeah, you please let me know when you're in town. I'll show you around for sure.
Yeah, sounds good, brother. Listen, all the best, and good luck, and hopefully we'll see you up in Picton.
Sounds good, partner.
Thank you. Have a great day, Adam. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You as well.